The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. Let's do the announcements and then off to our discussion with Dr. Eric Seedhouse. You can call us today. Our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. If you can't dial toll-free from whatever country you're in, email me and I'll give you the direct number for you to be able to make that call. Unfortunately, we don't accept collect calls. And by the way, our toll-free number is issued through MCI, so you might be able to use it from your country. Just call your operator and ask for your in-house MCI operator. Again, it's 1-866-687-7223. Email for today is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And please do remember that the Space Show is trademarked and copyrighted. You do have our permission to download these programs. They are compressed MP3s, and you're welcome to share them, pass them around, put them on a CD, DVD, memory stick, however you want to pass them around to help get the word out as to the importance and the purpose and all of the great benefits that are offered by our space program, both civil as well as private. The only restrictions are that you should not do anything commercial. Don't edit the programs, no private YouTube channels or anything like that. And written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. We're podcasting, and you can find our RSS URL on our website and both of our newsletters. And remember, we're in iTunes, Microsoft Zune, and a host of other places around the net. If you do have podcasting questions, please let me hear from you. We definitely answer your emails, and we'll do our best to help you resolve whatever your podcasting question or issue might be. Do go to our website. It is thespaceshow.com, so our comprehensive newsletter is uploaded Sunday after our Sunday program, or maybe early Sunday evening. And it has all of the week's details of the programs, and it has the complete bios of our guests, and it has the future events section for the Space Show. That's the only place we have that. So you can see what's upcoming on the program. And then if we have to make changes to the schedule or get some announcements out, this is where we do it first. And there you will also see an opportunity to subscribe to the very short email newsletter, which goes out early Monday morning, California time, guaranteed not to clutter up your mailbox. 1 or 2 lines about the week's programming. Everything we do on our program is archived. It goes back to the beginning in 2001, and we're approaching 1,800 programs. You can listen right off of our website or easily download the shows. Use the guest search tool. You can do global searches on it. Search for your favorite keyword, like radiation, for example, or microgravity or suborbital. And you can search for your favorite guest. For example, you can search for Dr. Eric Seedhouse, and you'll find all of the programs on which he has been a guest on the Space Show. Write down the dates, and then you can go back to our archives on our regular page and pull up each and every one of those programs by date. You'll see a Space Show store up at the top of our website. It's called Space Show Gear. Please do check it out. And then above all, you'll see the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3, and we only exist because of your generosity, and it's very important to us for your support, and we thank you very much for that. Remember, if you're paying United States federal taxes, you do get a deduction. If you pay California taxes, you get a deduction. Check with your tax people as to whether other states provide a deduction or not. I simply don't know the answer to that. And if you have any questions, go to the OneGiantLeapFoundation.org website. There's a lot of information about the parent owner of the space show, One Giant Leap Foundation. And we certainly thank you for your support. And then remember, the space show is brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, visit SecureWorldFoundation.org. They are the sponsors of our webinar program. We're working right now to set up our next one with Secure World for either a June date or a July date. We'll keep you posted on that. And that brings me to today's program, and it's a real pleasure, always an honor, and always informative to bring back to the show Dr. Eric Seathouse. He has a new book. He is really a prolific author. I finally got to meet Eric in person at the recent suborbital conference in Palo Alto, and that was very nice. But the book that he has currently written and that I'm holding in my hands and that we will talk about for the most part today is called Interplanetary Outpost, The Human and Technological Challenges of Exploring the Outer Planets. It's a very comprehensive discussion of moving out there and long-duration spaceflight, and I really recommend it. It's a Springer Praxis book. It's described as a step-by-step how the mission architecture will evolve, how crews will be selected and trained, and what the mission will entail from launch to landing. It addresses the effects that extended duration, radiation, communications, and isolation will have on the human body and how not only performance but behavior might be affected. His bio is already up on the website. He has been a guest on the program many, many times. So honestly, I'd rather talk to Eric than read more from his bio. But he is experienced. He's a Special Forces paratrooper guy from the Canadian Elite 2nd Battalion Parachute Regiment. When you meet him in person, he looks like a guy you wouldn't want to tangle with, let me tell you. He is trim, fit, looks like he'd be lightning fast. And did you have a lot of fun in that parachute regiment, or was it really hard work?
No, it's very, very tough. And the basic training?
Yeah, the whole thing, even when you went into the jungle, was it fun? Was there any fun to it at all?
Yeah, it was. I mean, we got to do everything that you see on the recruitment videos. We got to jump out of aircraft. We got to jump out of balloons. We jumped out of the back of Chinook. We were inserted into the jungle by Lynx helicopters. We got to fire all sorts of weapons, some weapons that weren't even on the market yet because we were asked to test fire them because we were an elite parachute battalion. We got to do some. We got to spend 6 months in Belize. I mean, people spend thousands and thousands of dollars just to spend 2 weeks there. We got to spend 6 months. We saw jaguars in the jungle. We saw third land snakes every day. We got to spend 10 days patrolling the border between Belize and Guatemala. Got to do desert warfare training in Cyprus with the Special Air Service, which is the elite Special Forces. Yeah, it was fantastic. I mean, it was a great time. It was very, very tough, but I mean, we got to do some great, great stuff.
Did the snakes come close to you, or you just see them from a distance?
Oh, no, they got close because we were doing, we'd go on patrol early in the morning, and sometimes we'd be stepping them on the trail.
What did you do to keep from getting bit?
Well, these snakes aren't too aggressive. The reason you don't see them is because they're yellow with black diamond on the back.
Yeah, they go in with the camouflage real well.
Yeah, so you don't really see them. But no, I don't think of anybody. I don't think any of us were bit by them.
Well, let's talk about Interplanetary Outpost. It is an exceptional book, and listeners, again, it is very comprehensive. It's probably in one place one of the most comprehensive discussions of this kind of a topic, from mission objectives to the human factor that we talk about, different potential hardware. Where do we stand on interplanetary travel for humans? I guess with sort of the budget problems and things like that, it's a little bit on hold, but you told me that it's, these problems are still being addressed, correct?
Yeah, many years ago it used to be the NASA Institute for Advanced Concepts, or NIAC, and about 10 years ago they decided to put together a mission architecture for missions beyond low Earth orbit and beyond Mars, because that's what everybody talks about is Mars. So they, NIAC, or the United States Advanced Concepts, came up with a group called the Human Outer Planet Exploration Group, or the HOPE mission. And what they did, they spent a year designing this mission. They decided on destination, which is Callisto, which is what I use in my book. They designed the mission architecture, how the crew would get there, which propulsion method they would use, how long they would stay on the surface, and how long they would get back. And then NIAC was disbanded in 2007, although it's been resurrected, thanks to Obama, actually. So it's going to start its work on exotic projects again. But in the interim, there are people still looking at human interplanetary missions, and one of those groups is the NASA Technology Applications Assessment Team, or the TAT. And two of the scientists there, Mark Alderman and Edward Henderson, came up with an exploration, multi-mission space exploration vehicle, which you can see on the NASA website. It's a very, very impressive vehicle, and they designed this for a similar mission to the outer planets, like Saturn and Jupiter, Titan, the moon, and that general region. And they're working very hard on these sort of missions, and they've put together a great mission architecture, and I actually use this as part of my book, and they were very helpful in providing the cover, not the picture of Callisto, but the spacecraft that you see on the cover of my book is the multi-mission space exploration vehicle designed by Mark Alderman and Edward Henderson. So it's good to know that work like this is still being done. It's just then more of it isn't being done.
In your opinion, what are the biggest hurdles to actually doing an interplanetary type of mission?
It's just the length of time. Obviously, there's a lot of talk about bone demineralization and muscle atrophy, and most recently, vision problems on the International Space Station, about astronauts almost going blind towards the end of their six-month increments, and then you extrapolate that to a three-year Mars mission. Obviously, we couldn't go to the outer planets, even the closest one, in much less than 5 or 6 years, even if we used something like Vladimir. So 5 years, best case scenario, that's just too long without medical intervention or some sort of biomedical intervention.
So how are these problems then being addressed? Or do they think they're going to come up with medical intervention, or what's the secret?
Yeah, there is. Many people will be surprised to know that the European Space Agency Advanced Concepts Team, ATT, they're actually working on human hibernation right now. And human hibernation is one way that we can get astronauts safely to the outer planets and beyond. And what they're doing, they've been looking at animal analogs. So they've looked at animals that hibernate naturally, such as ground squirrels, Arctic ground squirrels in particular. They've looked at how the ground squirrels hibernate. And then they've taken these animals that normally hibernate during winter and tried to get them to hibernate during the summer to see if they can trigger hibernation. So what they're looking for is something called a hibernation induction trigger. And they've found there's a specific hormone called DADL, leucotin, I think it's called. But anyway, DADL is a hormone that actually acts as this hibernation induction trigger. So the next step is actually to take that and see if we can develop a hibernation induction trigger for humans, and once we can do that, then we're well on our way to developing a human hibernation system.
Would such a system be needed for, say, a Mars mission or a Phobos mission, or that's not enough? That time frame is short enough to do it more or less conventionally.
Yeah, especially with the propulsion systems being investigated right now, we're probably looking at a Mars mission that probably won't take 3 years. When we're ready to do it, we'll have a propulsion system that will probably take maybe in the order of 6 to 7 weeks. So we probably don't need human hibernation for a Mars mission. But in terms of hibernation, some people get a little bit confused between the various hibernation methods. Hibernation is, when I'm talking about hibernation, I'm talking about how an animal hibernates. I'm not talking about stasis, where somebody is frozen. Freezing people is probably not the way to go, because it's very, very difficult to reanimate that person, because there are 14 different tissues in the body, and they all thaw out or defrost at different rates. So it'd be very, very messy to actually use stasis as a form of hibernation. So the hibernation I'm talking about is traditional animal hibernation, but applied to humans.
So, I conjure up pictures from Star Trek, right? You know, where they're in hibernation chambers or something like that. Is that actually sort of what you're talking about?
I use the example of Alien, the opening scene of Alien and Aliens when they wake up in the hibernation suite. So it's going to be a little bit like that. You're obviously going to have somewhere to lie down. It's going to be a hibernation suite, or hibernaculum, to use the correct term, and that's the actual term that's actually used to describe where people hibernate, or animals hibernate. And you'd start off with a hibernation induction trigger. Obviously, you'd do some tests on Earth to see how you react to coming out of hibernation, and that's probably the most dangerous aspect, is actually exiting hypersleep. Entering it isn't too much of a problem, because you just have the hibernation induction trigger do its job, you fall asleep, and then you wake up at the other end. But in terms of waking up, that's what they're not very sure. Animals have got it figured out, but to see some animals who come out of hibernation, they're a little bit discombobulated. It takes them a little bit of a while to sort out where they are and to come to their senses. And it'll be a little bit like that for humans. So the exit would be a little bit like somebody coming out of a coma. So there are actually methods to assess people once they come out of a coma. And it's actually called the Glasgow Coma Scale. And you have them do a series of tests to see their functionality. So obviously there are some numerical tests, some alphanumeric tests, some orthostasis tests, and a whole bunch of tests just to assess the person, assess the person's functionality. And that's something that they would have to do when it comes to hibernation.
Could you compare it to being given a general anesthetic for surgery?
It's probably much worse than that. It's probably more like coming out of a hangover, I think, coming out of hibernation. there was one film that got it right, and that was Pandorum. In the first few scenes of Pandorum, it's a movie that opens with people coming out of hypersleep, and they actually have a hypersleep disorientation manual. It's actually referred to in the first few scenes of that film, and that's something they would, astronauts would have to use, would be a hypersleep or hibernation disorientation manual. So in that manual, there would be a whole bunch of instructions that you'd have to use on the crew members coming out of hibernation to make sure that they're actually fit to carry on their duties.
Interesting. Would you submit to a test on the ground, you know, experiments? Would you do human experimentation on that?
Yeah, you'd have just like normal mission training. One mission increment training would be hibernating for a week, or hibernating for a few days, or hibernating for 2 weeks, and then seeing how you react. So it's not a new experience for you when you come out of hibernation in the real thing.
How do you maintain body weight and things like that during hibernation?
Nanotechnology, hopefully. Obviously there's a problem. Obviously, if you're hibernating for 6 months to a year or 2 years or longer, then the body's muscles and bones are atrophying because they're not being used.
Right.
So there are nanotechnological interventions on the horizon that can actually help by regenerating or maintaining cellular structures and bone structures, but we're not there yet. So that's another problem that we have to face when we come to developing the system.
What about the would these vehicles, would they be spinning for artificial gravity? What would they specifically be doing to counter microgravity issues, bone loss, muscle atrophy? It couldn't all be countered just by being in hibernation, or would it all be countered by being in hibernation?
There are various options. One option, I mean, the most elegant one, is to spin the spaceship. Kent Houston, who's a NASA engineer, came up with this proposal. I think it's a 43-meter arm that spins around an axis. So the habitat is at one end of the axis, and then there's a propulsion module that actually creates a spinning effect on the other end of the axis. And in the center is a propulsive module for the actual spacecraft itself. So the actual spacecraft spins all the way to its destination. And on that 43-meter swing arm, you get, I think, half a G of gravity. So that's one way to go. The problem with that is that you get gyroscopic precession. So anytime you spin something like a spacecraft, you get gyroscopic precession, which actually affects navigation. So you have to have something to counteract the gyroscopic precession, and that's a problem that they haven't overcome, but it's certainly not a problem that's not something they can resolve. So that's one option.
What is that? What it means that you're drifting? Is that what it means?
Yeah, so you're actually going off your course, basically. So you're going
right,
slightly off course all the time with this spinning action, the centripetal force. and that creates this gyroscopic precession, and that means you have to continually adjust your course to make sure you're actually on the right track.
Here's your first question by email. It is Arnie is in Houston. Excuse me. And Arnie says, do you think the research and development that you're talking about for an interplanetary type of mission in the future will be done by government researchers, or do you think because of the economic problems, not just in the U.S. but also in Europe, that much of this research is going to be done by the private sector?
Well, it's a difficult one to call. I mean, if you were to embark on an interplanetary mission, I mean, if you take the decision now or in 5 years to embark on an interplanetary mission, I think it would have to be a combination of nation states. So you're looking at NASA, the European Space Agency, and maybe the Russians all together, all coming together to put together a human interplanetary mission, because obviously there's a cost associated with this. It's not cheap. Although, having said that, the multi-mission exploration vehicle that I mentioned that was designed by Mark Haldeman at NASA, that came in at $3.7 billion. And that sounds a lot of money, but they've actually spent $5 billion just developing Orion right now, and that's old technology, and they haven't even flight-tested that one yet.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so the actual vehicle itself is relatively affordable. It's the rest of the mission that can be quite expensive. So I think, having said that, in the future, I think the tradition will be for commercial ventures to actually finance these missions. So we know that Elon Musk of SpaceX has talked about his ambition to go to Mars in the next 10, 15 years. And I know Bigelow has plans to put a lunar base or to establish a lunar base. And I think that's the way things are going to go from now on, is that commercial ventures are going to fund these beyond low Earth orbit missions.
Mark Haldeman was actually a guest on the show in May of last year, and he talked about his project and ideas. He had something called Niagara, something like that.
Nautilus.
Nautilus, thank you.
Yeah, I think it's the longest acronym NASA has. It's his spacecraft.
Listeners, you can find him if you want to hear that show, and he's a very interesting guy with big vision ideas. And that is in the middle of May of last year. So you can go to May 2011 on the website, and you'll find him and pick it up. You said Callisto was the first choice, right?
Yeah, so what I do in the book, I say, right, okay, we decided we want to go on an interplanetary mission, and the first thing to do is to decide on destination. So I don't just decide on Callisto, I just go through, okay, well, what are the other options? Like, what are the potential destinations? We can go to the moons of Saturn, Enceladus, Titan, or we can go to the moons of Jupiter, such as Europa or Callisto. And I look at the various pros and cons of each, you know, the radiation environment, the gravity, orbital characteristics, the actual mission difficulties of actually getting to each, the distance and everything else, and taking all those factors into consideration, I came up with Callisto, which happily aligns with the Human Outer Planets exploration team 10 years ago. So that was the destination they chose. And it's a relatively low radiation environment. It's an interesting celestial body. It's pretty pockmarked with craters, but it's relatively close by because it's a moon of Jupiter as opposed to a moon of Saturn. Obviously, Saturn is further away. And a mission architecture exists for getting there. So I guess you could argue that I took the easy way out because the mission architecture existed to a certain degree. But I actually add a lot of elements to that mission architecture, such as the use of human hibernation, the use of the Vladimir, and things like that.
excuse me, I would have thought Mars or one of the moons for Mars would have been the primary mission goal.
Well, the thing is, I couldn't have sold that book because there are so many books written about Mars, and there's a sort of saturation in terms of books written about Mars. There's
uh-huh.
so many books, there's really no, well, there are very few new angles to come up with for a Mars mission. So I can go to the bookshop and pull up a book on Mars exploration. The reason I write these books are, well, primarily, it's a book that I'd like to find in the library or find in the bookshop. And when I searched, I could find no book about missions beyond Mars. So that's why, that's one of the reasons I wrote this book.
You have Sally, and Sally is in my area, Berkeley, California. Hear from her occasionally by email. And Sally says, of all of the human factors, what do you think is the hardest one to resolve? Is it radiation or is it the bone loss issue? You also mentioned earlier now that we're finding vision problems based on the space station. Can you also elaborate about vision issues?
Yeah, this is something I picked up in 2005, and in the Journal of Ophthalmology in October 2011, they actually published the first pivotal article about this that actually looked at seven astronauts who'd been affected. One of those astronauts was actually taken off a mission because his vision didn't come back. It's a very, very serious issue, and it's only for those astronauts that have been on station for 4 months or longer. Obviously, the longer you are on station, generally the more pronounced those vision problems are. And they really don't know what's causing this. They think part of it may be the pressure, because obviously when you're in microgravity, you have increased pressure in the upper half of your body. And after a long period of time, that extra pressure may create pressure in the optic nerve. They're very serious about this, but they haven't resolved it. But it's a very, very high level, very high priority issue. For example, when I went to Anchorage last year for the Aerospace Medical Conference, there were at least half a dozen presentations on this. It's something that NASA takes very, very seriously, because obviously if they have astronauts that end up being blind by the time they get to Mars, it's not a very good mission outcome.
Now, my understanding is that it only is affecting men. Is that correct?
So far, they've only looked at men, yeah.
So they haven't looked at women.
Well, there's a very small N number for women, and as far as I know, the Journal of Ophthalmology article just looked at seven men. There were no women in that group, as far as I remember. So, they don't know what causes this, and from the suggestions they're making or the theories that they're suggesting, there would be no reason to think that women wouldn't be affected as well.
And no ideas for remedies or treatments or countermeasures, right?
Not now, no.
Now, did the astronauts discover a vision problem while in space, or was it only when they got home?
No, it's actually when they're on station. So what they do now, some of the astronauts have to take glasses up to correct their vision, because they, towards the end of the mission, a long increment mission beyond 4 months, some of them experience vision problems that are so bad that can only be corrected with glasses.
Okay, so if we go back to what Sally asked you, and you zero out the vision, where do you think the biggest human factor challenges are? Is it radiation? And how would one of these vehicles be shielded while you're in hibernation and for the duration of the mission?
Well, first of all, there's no one solution. There's no magic bullet that solves the radiation problem. It's basically a number of factors that you have to integrate into the mission architecture. So for one, is the shielding. Obviously, there's what they're looking at now is polyethylene, because it's hydrogen. Hydrogen is a big atom, so it actually helps protect astronauts from radiation. And also, polyethylene is very light, so they can use that as shielding. But obviously, there's a limit to how much shielding you can put on a spacecraft. And obviously, you're in deep space, and NASA has no limits. No limits in terms of what those radiation thresholds are in deep space. So shielding is one option. On top of that, you'd have to have medical intervention. So you'd have to have drugs available, such as amifostine. And these drugs would be available in the event of a solar storm, which hopefully the astronauts would be given forewarning about, but not necessarily. You'd have a radiation shelter. So the spaceship would be designed with a radiation shelter. So that would probably be in the core of the ship. It would be surrounded by the water stores. And hopefully that would be sufficient to protect the astronauts in the event of a solar storm or a solar flare event.
But if such an event came along and you're hibernating, what the heck do they do then?
Well, two ways you can get around this. One, depending on which science fiction films you've seen, in some mission architectures you have a crew that is always awake, or at least one crew member that is awake, or a couple of crew members that are awake in that eventuality. So if there is a solar storm, then you'd wake up the crew and you'd get down to the radiation shelter. So that film that I mentioned before, Pandorum, what they did in that film every 2 years, a new crew would wake up and take the place of the previous crew, so there'd always be a manned presence on the deck. Another option is just to harden the hibernation suite. So you'd have the hibernation suite or the hibernaculum in the most radiation-protected area of the ship. So those would be two ways you could resolve that.
Do you age while you're hibernating? Is there any real information on that?
With regard to human hibernation, we don't know.
So you can't say one way or the other?
No. They haven't done any human hibernation studies.
Really fascinating.
Having said that, there are journals. There's actually journal articles that are published on the subject of human hibernation because I think it was a journal of New England Journal of Medicine. Over 100 years ago, they found some Russian peasants that actually did hibernate for about 6 months of the year. So because the weather up there, up in Siberia, was so, so bad that they actually had developed biological mechanisms that regulated the metabolic activity and temperature for long periods of time, and these peasants have actually got used to reducing body temperature and heart rate and brain activity, and actually they stayed below normal boundaries for up to 6 months of the year.
Pretty fascinating. Eric, we're at the bottom of the hour. We're going to pause and take our first break. And listeners, we're open for the phone lines more than email, of course. 1-866-687-7223. Remember, we take your calls during the break and hold you over. And back in 3 minutes with Dr. Seathouse.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. This is the second segment of our Sunday Space Show. And our guest today is Dr. Eric Seathouse. We're talking about his book and the subject, Interplanetary Outposts, The Human and Technological Challenges of Exploring the Outer Planets. Our first caller is with us, and it is Marshall from, are you still in Texas or have you moved to Oklahoma yet?
Well, I'm in Texas today.
Okay. You have a comment or question for Eric, please.
Dr. Seathouse, I see that you're something of an athlete, and since interplanetary travel is going to be long and drawn out with months of boredom, I've had a lot of imaginary plans and ideas for 0G, 1/2G, 1G, and even a 1.5G sports in space. Has anybody ever really written anything or worked through some kind of space game to keep the astronauts or not mentally sharp and physically in condition?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, in my architecture, my astronauts sleep on their way, so they don't have to worry too much about playing sports. But if they weren't hibernating, then obviously they'd be spending 3 hours a day on the treadmill, it sort of might take away their inclination to play other sports because they'd have to spend that amount of time on the treadmill just to make sure they maintain bone density and keep their muscles in good working order. But I mean, in terms of the games you could play, it's obviously determined by the constraints of the spacecraft design. It depends on how much space you have in there. I mean, obviously, the gymnastics is an obvious one. Maybe clear a bit of the space there to play zero-G handball. I mean, there's a few options there. I mean, that, but in terms of the sports that you play in space, then the ones I'd be interested in would be the ones that you play once you get to the destination. So, for example, when you get to Mars, you've got a big mountain called Olympus Mons, which is 15 miles high. Now, to put that in perspective, Mount Everest is just 5.5 miles high. So there's a big big summit there waiting for somebody to climb one day. Also, the Valles Marineris, which is probably a great place to explore and abseil into because that's much deeper than the Grand Canyon. And then you can go skiing on the ice cap in Mars as well. So I think the sports I'd be interested in would be the ones where you... the ones we can carry out of the destination.
I like that idea, combining video games and physical exercise. That's good. I was actually thinking about coming out of hibernation, having a coordination sport of some kind that you play against each other, because there's one thing, the competitive edge is what really keeps people in shape, I think.
Yeah, I don't think you'd use too many sports to actually determine if somebody's functional. I mean, it's like I say, as I mentioned before, it will be a little bit like coming out of a coma. So you have to ensure consistent movement. You have to make sure those movements are reproducible. You have to make sure that they can hear properly, they can see properly, that they can speak properly. You have to make sure that they can recognize objects. Make sure that they can fixate on objects normally. All these tests you have to do, and obviously object manipulation, localization to stimuli, flexion, abnormal posturing, all these sort of things would have to be done first. So I'm not sure if sports would integrate very well into the actual exit from hibernation.
Well, it was a fascinating idea, and I do like your video game plan on it. That's pretty nice.
Have you seen his book, Marshall?
No, I haven't.
You should check it out. I think you would find it really informative, and I guarantee you would like it.
Yeah, well, one of my thoughts is, like you have a room with half G, and you have low air pressure. You have, like on a ping pong ball, you have a very low drag ball flying through the air and, bouncing way up in the air to do your return mash, back and forth. It could be quite exhilarating, even though you don't really have a lot of gravity or much air, and so you get interesting physical phenomena that change the game, and then you can go to the other extreme and actually have above 1G gravity and double the air pressure, and the ball is in a very high drag atmosphere, and, you have a real problem moving around. So, it gets fun just by having the capacity to change the physical parameters that you can't change on Earth.
Marshall, you should attend a new space conference sometime or even ISDC, because this is where you see people writing up ideas like you're talking about and presenting papers in different sections and subsections. And, over the years, I've heard tons and tons of ideas for sports and space. Whether any of them will ever materialize or happen is who knows. But
yeah.
There's no shortage in the space enthusiast community of people putting forth their ideas for how this might work. I've even seen swimming pools and sort of a hang gliding contest in basketball.
Oh, basketball would be absolutely fun because, all of a sudden a guy is doing a low-G gym and literally jumping 500-600 feet to sink a basket. Loads of fun.
Anything else?
No, that's enough fun for me.
Thank you for calling in.
Okay, bye.
Bye. That does open up our line, listeners, and if you would like to use it, it is 1-866-687-6607. 7223. Eric, what has to happen in terms of policy? That's probably not the way to ask it. In order to really start a serious interplanetary space exploration program that ultimately leads to humans doing this, what has to happen in the early phases? What do we have to start doing now or in the near future that we're not doing now?
Well, I think you have to look back over 100 years to the golden era of exploration, back in the days of the Arctic explorers, Antarctic explorers.
Uh-huh.
And back then, it was a high-profile venture. These were big name celebrities, these people who went out and ventured into the unknown, people like Amundsen and Nansen and Shackleton and Mawson, all these people. People followed on tenterhook, you know, to find out what happened on these expeditions that would last 3 or 4 years or more. This is back in the day without any fax machines or, you know, TV hookups or anything like that. And, like I say, I think we've become soft. The will to explore has gone. I mean, if you go into the street now and take a straw poll of kids and ask them who their heroes are, I mean, it's football players and golf players and basketball players. 100 years ago, it would be explorers. And I think there has to be something of a shift in people's perceptions in terms of what it means to explore and what the returns are. And part of the job of selling that is are the space agencies. So they would have to do a better job, I think, in the public relations department of actually selling these missions to the public, because otherwise these missions won't get funded.
So do we need a big name person, for example, saying, I'm going to put together an interplanetary mission? Is that the idea? I don't know who a big name person would be, but would it be a Hollywood person, or what would it be?
I don't think it has to be a big name person. I think it's they just have to find a reason to persuade people that this is a viable venture and it's worthwhile pursuing. And right now, you ask people, why should we go to Mars? And most people wouldn't be able to give you an answer to that.
Yeah, especially young kids. The surveys of the Gen Y group were overwhelmingly had no interest in going to Mars.
Yeah, because it hasn't been sold to them in the way it needs to be sold. If that happens, then, I mean, if we can't even get to Mars, then there's certainly no hope for us going beyond Mars.
So how would you sell it? I mean, this seems to be the 64... As Neil deGrasse Tyson said before the Senate hearings the other day, the multi-billion-dollar question is how do you sell this kind of stuff to resonate and connect with people? And I agree with you. It's definitely missing, and it definitely requires something other than what we've been doing in the past.
I mean, if you want to sell it, then get somebody like Neil deGrasse Tyson on a soapbox, because he does a fantastic job. I mean, that guy is just...
Well, he is on the soapbox for it,
Is, but he needs more exposure, that guy. I mean, if you put him on all the talk shows, then I think he'd have a lot a grind club support for this, because the message would get through.
You know, he was on the show last Tuesday, and I asked him... if being on Jon Stewart, Bill Maher, all of these shows where all they do is laugh and have fun and poke jokes and it's silly and you know, it's humorous, if that detracts from being able to sell the mission. And then, you know, he gave us a little discourse on how powerful humor is at selling something. And I'm just wondering if, say, the Jon Stewart audience or the Bill Maher audience, after hearing all the jokes and the sarcastic and humorous comments, if they have been, they sure like Neil, because he's really, he's Mr. Personality Plus. I mean, he's a superstar. Does that translate in them wanting to explore? I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I think it will if they go and buy his book, because it's all out there in his book. I mean,
well, maybe they'll download it on a Kindle or iBooks or something.
Yeah, I mean, if they read his book, then that will invigorate most people, because Neil's writing is grabs you by the throat, basically. It holds your attention all the way through the book, and it's very, very persuasive as well. He makes a very good case. So hopefully if they go out and buy the book, then that will convince a lot of people.
You have another caller. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
Hi, this is Terry, Corpus Christi.
Hi, Terry. How you doing?
I'm fine. How are y'all?
We're hanging in there.
Hanging in there.
Waiting to sell it. I want to go explore.
Yeah. Eric, you have a fantastic background. What do you think, don't you think that human evolution as far as physically, heart, blood pressure, those sorts of things are part of the equation as far as mankind moving on out into space? Maybe several generations that are born in space, wouldn't their heart, eyes, blood pressure, all of that adapt at least somewhat to the rigors of space?
Well, over generations, I mean, in the book, I make a case for genetic profiling to select only those people who are best suited for long-duration spacecraft. So, for example, there are some people who are more radiation resistant, so you'd obviously include those. So there are some people who have higher bone density, so you'd obviously include those. It's not a very fair way of selecting people, but it's one way. In terms of adaptation, then yes, you definitely, over generations, you'd see adaptation. And eventually, obviously, the first baby would be born in zero-G, and that'd be interesting to see how that adapts. So that would obviously be the first step in adaptation to a space-faring species. And yes, you're looking at obviously things like bone density. Obviously, if it's in a perpetual zero-G environment, then people will be born with less bone density because there's no reason to have high bone density in a zero-G environment. But the destinations we're talking about, Mars and Callisto and Europa, places like that, those are places which do have a gravity, so maybe only a third or a quarter of the gravity of Earth. So people who are on those planets will obviously adapt to the environment, specific to the radiation environment and specific to the gravitational environment. So it will be destination specific.
Well, it would be amazing to see maybe two or three generations out that never have even been on Earth and see how they would adapt to space. It would be fascinating to just see what kind of changes there would be physically.
But also you can preempt that because on the horizon we have genetic engineering, so why not genetically engineer a human to that environment? So, for example, you can, I know we're not supposed to be doing human genetic engineering, but sooner or later it will happen. We're also talking about bioprinting a human now. So, for example, right now we have 3D printers that actually print out blood vessels. The next stage is to actually print out individual organs. And, of course, there's discussion recently about bioprinting a human. And so you can custom design human beings, maybe not for the next 10, 15 years, but certainly, 30 or 40 years in the future, you may be able to customize a human or genetically engineer a human specific to the environment. And then you don't have to worry about the adaptation or you don't have to worry about the changes taking over a generation.
Well, that's a fascinating thought. It's really great talking to you. I'll go ahead and clear the line so someone else can call in. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Terry.
Good question.
Callers, it is 1-866-687-7223. You have Harry in Los Angeles. What do you think the story will be on these long missions and possible preemptive surgery? For example, would they remove a gallbladder before you went or some other thing that might be helpful, because if you had an attack while you're on a long duration space mission, there might not be a solution to helping you.
Yeah, before I included that section on preemptive surgery, I talked to at least two NASA flight surgeons and also a couple of people who work in the medical arena for spaceflight. And they said maybe not the gallbladder, but definitely appendix. Because if you were to have appendicitis en route to Mars, then you just wouldn't have the trauma care necessary. You would just not have the medical care necessary to deal with appendicitis and have somebody remove your appendix. We've got limited experience in parabolic flight in terms of what we can and cannot do with in terms of medical intervention. But on an interplanetary mission, somebody with appendicitis, that's almost a death sentence. So it just makes sense to have preemptive surgery for that.
Why not necessarily the gallbladder? I would think that if you had to have it taken out, it would be horribly painful if you didn't, and probably it could burst.
Well, from my discussions with flight surgeons, they said it's less likely to fail than an appendix. So in terms of the number of people who have appendix compared to the number of people who have problems with their appendix compared to the number of people who have problems with the gallbladder, there are fewer problems with the gallbladder.
Are we advancing at all on being able to do real surgery in microgravity? For example, could you do cardiac surgery on a long-duration spaceship? Are we moving along fast enough to be able to do that?
Yeah, on one of my parabolic flights back in all the way back in 95, one of the tests was doing CPR, so cardiopulmonary resuscitation, on a pig. So what they did, they had this pig that was strapped into a cage, so it was upside down, so it was facing head up, and what they had to do there to try and figure out a way to do cardiopulmonary resuscitation, so basically doing the inflations on the chest in zero G. So the way they did it, their feet were on the ceiling, so they actually had some structure to actually press against, and then they used that as a fulcrum to actually exert pressure on the pig's chest. So basically the person was upside down, feet were on the ceiling, and they were pressing down on the pig's chest, the pig was on the floor, and that's how they did CPR in parabolic flight. So they've been doing these tests for, you know, a couple of decades now, and so they figured out CPR, they can do that, they can do mouth-to-mouth and everything else. Doing surgery, they're still working on that. I mean, there's problems with blood. I mean, obviously, you have to be able to contain the blood, because in zero-G, it can get a bit messy. So obviously, that's another reason for artificial gravity, because you'd obviously have the medical suite in the artificial gravity section of the compartment of the spacecraft.
Very interesting, for sure. So do you think the pre-screen, we haven't talked about crew selection, so let's talk about this. Would crew selection hopefully rule out people who maybe would have a gallbladder problem or a heart issue or something like that? Would that be the effect of screening people? And I guess they could do genetic screening and see if this or that illness or disease was in your family and maybe rule you out on that basis too.
Yeah, they would. You're looking at a very expensive mission, looking at a very long mission, I mean, the mission I talk about in my book, the last 5 years. So you have to have a very, very robust medical profile when you select for this mission. So yes, you have to start genetically testing people. I know that's against you're not allowed to do that in most, including all countries, but it'll be a little bit like signing on to the military. So basically you waive your rights. And so for the purposes of the space agency, they will embark on genetic testing to make sure that they've got the most robust medical individuals. And that would include past history for heart disease, obviously psychiatric problems, problems with the appendix and the gallbladder and so forth. And then once you've passed that hurdle, then you probably move on to the preemptive surgery and have the appendix removed. Before you actually fit for training.
Were you genetically screened for special forces or for your effort to be a Canadian astronaut?
No, we're not allowed to do that in Canada either.
So they can medically screen you, but no genetic screening?
Yeah, I mean, the medical test is extensive, and if you go to my book, there's literally two pages, and it's just a table, and it's just a list of, I think, over 50 tests that they do. It takes a long time. They set aside a whole week just for the medical tests. I mean, that includes two psychiatric interviews, which last between an hour, hour and a half. And that's just the psychiatric element. I mean, there's a lot of tests.
to see if you're going to go postal on them, right, when they ask you all
that's
these
it,
questions.
Yeah.
What about your, you know, I didn't mention, but you are part of Astronauts for Hire. Have you done any screening with them, and what is that like?
No, for our flight members, we require an FAA Class 3 medical, which is the same that you require for to be a private pilot. I mean, eventually, as we move on, then hopefully we'll have testing, in-house testing. But for now, that's all we ask for. We just ask them to provide a certificate for FAA Class 3.
You have another question, and this is John is in Denver. And he said, David has talked about these long flights on several space shows. It seems that there's another protocol that people don't like to talk about, and that's what to do with a body if one of the crew members dies during the mission. Do you have that covered in your book? And what are the current thoughts on body disposal, or do you return it back to Earth?
Yeah, so I include a bioethics appendix in my book, because that's really something that they don't really address. So there's no... So what I did, I called it the Interplanetary Bioethics Manual, and because there's no such document that exists in NASA or any space agency. There's no document that you can go to in the International Space Station that says, look, these are procedures for flushing a body out of the airlock. There's nothing like that. But if you're on an interplanetary mission and you have somebody die, then for the well-being of the crew, for the morale of the crew, it's not a good idea to have that dead body on board. I mean, if you've got another 2 years of the mission, you have somebody die, having that body stored somewhere on the ship is not going to be good for morale. So the decision would rest with the commander, I think. Obviously, the family would be consulted, mission control would be consulted. The family might ask for the body to be returned for autopsy, whatever, but I think that would be discounted, and you'd probably have something akin to burial at sea. So you have the body in the airlock, and you'd have a little ceremony, and you'd flush the body out of the airlock.
The family members aren't going to be too happy about that, but I guess they've signed on for it when they sign on for the crew.
Well, yes, it's, like I say, it's a little bit like joining the military, I think. I think it will be like that, but you waive a lot of your rights, if not all your rights.
And the family waives their rights too then, correct?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, in the book, I give a couple of scenarios with regard to ethics. I mean, one of them includes a crew member dying. Another scenario is, you know, there's a lot of family members are killed in an accident back on Earth. Do you tell the people on the mission? I mean, what happens if you just maybe a day from entering the atmosphere? If it involves a complex sequence of events, you obviously have to have clear thinking. Do you tell the crew that you know, one of their family members has been killed, or do you wait until they're on the surface, or do you wait until they come back to Earth? I mean, there's an awful lot of situations or scenarios that you can think of that requires ethical guidance.
We don't have any. Wouldn't they realize that something was wrong if they're no longer in contact with their family member?
Well, they'd have obviously be in contact with mission control. They'd be assigned times during the day, just like they have on the International Space Station right now, which are, you know, personal time. I've forgotten whether it's 15 minutes or 30 minutes when they can actually speak to a member directly. But
well, they'd suspect if all of a sudden they had no more contact with their family member.
Mission Control would, I think, screen that information from them.
What do you think? Should they tell the crew member that their family member was killed? What's your suggestion?
Well, we've faced this before on missions already. For example, Dan Tanney, who's an American astronaut, his grandmother died while he was on station. They told him immediately, because that's what he asked, because they asked the astronauts, okay, if a family member dies, do you want to be told or not? And they say, yes, I do, or no, I don't. In his case, he wanted to be told, so they told him. He was given a couple of days light duties, and then he was back in the crew. In the Russian experience, I've forgotten who it was, but one of the Russian cosmonauts back in the near days, his father died, and they didn't tell him. In fact, they even wrote letters written by his dad and sent them up with the Soyuz capsule. So they actually forged letters written by his dad saying his dad was still fine. So that really upset him when he got back to Russia to find his dad was dead. So they probably didn't do a very good job in terms of the ethics decision, the Russians. So we have faced similar problems like this already.
Excuse me, Larry is in Tucson, Arizona, and he has an email question. And he says, how far along are we in developing the truly closed environmental life support systems that would be needed on a long-duration flight like this? Are we there yet, or do we still have a lot of work to do?
We're getting there, but no, we do have a lot of work to do because I mean, if you go to Biosphere, that's where they tested the closed environmental life support system, and they did have problems, both in Biosphere 1 and Biosphere 2. Where did you say it was coming from?
Tucson.
Tucson, so it's not that far away from Biosphere.
It's just on the north end of the town.
That's right, yeah, it's not that far away. So, yeah, so he's probably familiar with Biosphere and the problems they had. But, yes, in terms of one that lasts 4 to 5 years, we still have a good way to go. So right now we're looking at maybe bioregenerative life support system, BLSS, which performs most of the basic functions on a regenerative process, but isn't closed. So right now, if we were to embark on this interplanetary mission, then we'd probably have to take a fair amount of food and drinking water with us.
So given where we are today with all of the elements that would comprise this mission, and let's assume it's adequately funded, whatever adequate funding means. We're zeroing out the issue of funding. We're going to assume we have sufficient funding. How long do you think it would be before such a mission would actually launch?
If we have the funding.
The funding is no longer an issue. So the project is funded. So now it's an issue of developing the technology, researching it, coming up with all of what you've been talking about for the past hour. Can we do it in 3 years from now, 20 years from now? How much time do you think it would take us to be ready to launch?
I think the main sticking point is the Vladimir, the propulsion system, or something equivalent to a propulsion system that gets us there in 5 years if we're talking about getting to Callisto. The spacecraft, Mark Alderman did a fantastic job designing that spacecraft. I mean, we can build that. The artificial gravity, the one aspect of Mark Alderman's spacecraft is a centrifuge, which they're trying to get flown on the International Space Station in 2014, 2015, to see how well that works. So the artificial gravity might be resolved within the next 3 or 4 years, or partially resolved. And then you're looking at radiation. The spaceship that Mark Alderman designed, that does have a radiation shelter. So you're good to go on a lot of fronts. I would say if you have the funding now, you could probably make a go of it within the decade.
So on the outer side of a decade.
Yeah.
You have another email. And again, listeners, the line is open instead of email. 1-866-687-7223. Terry says, what about interstellar flights that are multi-generational? How would you make sure some were doctors, different flight system engineers, etc.?
How do I make sure?
Yeah, I guess he's talking about if you're spanning multi-generations, how do you know that whoever grows up on the mission is actually going to be a doctor or an engineer, or I guess that's what he's asking.
Yes, I suppose you'd have to have a comprehensive library education system, and obviously you'd have to make sure that with each generation, a certain proportion of the crew member are educated to be engineers, a certain number are educated to be doctors.
Well, what do you force them to be, a doctor or an engineer? I mean, what if they say, no, I want to be a poet, or I want to be a hippie, you know, or whatever?
That's tough, isn't it?
I mean, you're talking about people being born in space and growing up there, and we hope they choose relevant careers where they can be trained so that they can contribute to the mission. But, you know, what if they want to drop out?
Tough. That's pretty much it. Yeah, that's the hardship of interstellar exploration. I think there was actually a book written on that subject, multi-generational spaceships. I think NASA or ESA that's doing the Starship project, the 100-year project? DARPA's doing that, yeah. So I think I'm not sure if they've addressed those sort of issues, but I think it'll just be a case of, you want to be a poet? Well, plus you're going to have to be an engineer.
And this assumes they have the capability mentally to be an engineer.
Well, hopefully with the careful screening of the first crew, then... hopefully that DNA, the genetic follow-on, will carry on from one generation to the next.
I think there's going to need to be an engineering pill and a surgeon pill, and you're going to remember the Star Trek where you put the helmet on and it trained you for whatever it was with super duper knowledge. It was a planet of all women or something like that, and McCoy put the helmet on to learn how to do brain surgery on Spock.
That's a long time ago.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's what they'll need to do, is take the multi-generational crew and put them into a chamber and put the helmet on, and voila, this one's an aerospace engineer. This one's a cardiac surgeon. Maybe that's how the advanced technology will do it.
Yeah, it's difficult to say. But...
interesting. Assuming they're government astronauts doing this, then assuming they're getting paid, So I'm making another. I mean, whoever thinks of this stuff. So I guess their families back on Earth get their paycheck, right?
Yeah.
I mean, does anyone ever think this far out and think about things like this?
Actually, that's one topic that I haven't looked at. But I mean, yeah, I guess there'll be all sorts of clauses in there in the expedition contracts in terms of what happens. You know, what if you know, if they don't return, and you know, all the mission bonuses, expedition bonuses. Obviously, it has the duty pay, so you get it extra. Just like being in the military, really. If you go on an expedition, you don't pay taxes. So not expedition. If you go on a deployment, should I say, you don't pay taxes. So, for example, Canadian Forces personnel who go to Afghanistan for 6 months, they don't pay taxes for 6 months. Plus, they get a deployment bonus. They come back with $20,000 plus. So it's financially, it's a good deal. I mean, for your health, it's not a good deal because you might get shot and killed. And it's the same with these space missions. So you may get hazardous duty allowance and deployment allowance, and maybe not have to pay taxes. I don't know. I mean, that's one way of looking at it, one way of looking at the incentives, because obviously you have the families left behind, so it's hard on the families. So obviously there has to be an increment, a pay increment there to take that into consideration.
Do you have a brig on this spaceship? I mean, do you have some enforcement and penalty and restraint system for people who break whatever laws are in force on the mission?
One of the questions when it comes to bioethics is, do you carry a straitjacket on board? And where do you have the brig? And that was one of the questions I asked when I joined the Navy, because there's no brig on Canadian Forces frigates. There are on some American warships. But what we do, we have a decontamination room in the, I think, on two decks, which is the one below the deck that you actually go on ship. And so if something misbehaves, you actually turn the decontamination facility into a brig. So in terms of a spaceship, then... Did somebody ask this question, or is this your question, David?
One could go crazy with this. What do you do with an unwanted pregnancy on the mission?
Okay, so I actually include that in my book.
Oh, really? What do you do? What did you suggest?
Well, you have to terminate it, obviously. Yeah, you just can't carry it to term, because there's all sorts of problems. So when you get to your destination, you're including maybe one or two more crew members that are involved. You're actually taking one or two or more crew members away from their duties to look after the baby, because, okay, which part of the outpost or which part of the base becomes the babysitting facility? There isn't one, because it's not planned in the mission profile. And then you've got that person who's just given birth. She's pretty much out of commission because she has to look after the kids. So then you've got these all these mission duties. I mean, these mission duties are planned very, very carefully, down to the minute. Probably might not be quite as precise in the interplanetary mission because of the length of the mission. But if you go on the International Space Station, look at the duties, they're planned down to the minute. And if you've got all of a sudden you've got one mission member taken out of rotation, that's a huge burden on the other crew members. So yes, it would just be, the decision would be clear cut, black and white, and that would be terminate.
Or I guess you could compel a requirement for sterilization to be on the mission.
That's another aspect of the mission planning, is that before you go on this interplanetary mission, the chances are you're going to come back sterile. So the men would bank their sperm, and the women would bank their eggs.
And that's because of the radiation, right?
That's right, yeah, because the chances are you'd come back sterile. So that's a way around that. So that's another part of the medical selection. So you have to sign on to that as well.
I talk about full disclosure, right?
Yeah, so it's a pretty long medical process for getting on this mission.
Chris is in Chicago, and his email question is there any work that needs to be done on spacesuits? Do they need to be upgraded for this kind of a mission?
Well, yeah. The ones we have right now are pretty bulky, and I'd be glad to know there's a lot of, there's some work being done on mechanical counter-pressure suits. So these are figure-hugging suits, and there's a woman called Dava Newman at MIT. She's been working on this for the last 10 years with her PhD students, and it's a very, very nice suit. It's a suit that you expect to see in science fiction films, but it's real. I mean, it's actually something they've developed, they've tested. She's been featured in New Scientist magazine and Popular Science and Popular Mechanics, all these magazines wearing this suit. Like I say, it's figure hugging, mechanical counter pressure, so if it punctures, then you're safe. And you're still wearing the helmet, but it's a much lighter helmet. The current suit that we have now that you would wear on the surface of Mars or the surface of Callisto weighs about 25 kilos, so about 50 pounds, so it's pretty heavy. This one weighs not even a quarter of that. It weighs about a third. So it's about 10, 15 pounds. It weighs very little at all. So it just makes it a lot easier because metabolically you're not using as much energy just to physically move in the suit. So it's not a good idea to use the suits we have right now. And also it's better in terms of mobility because these bulky suits that we have right now, it's actually difficult to actually do precise science and do good work. It just takes a lot longer because you have this extra weight you have to move around. And so there's a lot of reasons for having an upgrade suit on these missions.
You have another email question, and it is Robert, who is in St. Louis. And Robert says, I'm assuming that you have non-space enthusiast friends in Canada and that you have a life beyond the space industry. I'm curious to the reaction of these friends of yours to the books that you write and to these subjects. Do you talk to them about something like an interplanetary outpost or long-duration spaceflight or some of the issues you've been talking about today? Do you avoid topics like that with your non-space friends? What is their reaction or their thoughts about your space involvement and some of the issues you deal with and write about?
First time I've been asked that question. It's a good one. So my other life is as a triathlon coach. So
as a what coach?
A triathlon coach.
Oh, okay.
A professional triathlete. And when I'm not doing my regular job, when I'm not doing this, I'm coaching triathletes. So all they want to talk about is triathlon, which is good because I don't have to think about space because it's not a good idea to be focused on just one subject all the time. It makes you pretty much a one-dimensional person. So they really, some of them don't even know I do this. They really don't, because when I talk to them, all they're interested in is wheel sets and aerodynamics and clipless pedals and Ironman training and half Ironman training and nutrition and things like that. So that's what we talk about. We don't talk about it. I honestly can't remember a single conversation I've had about space with my triathletes.
I think I have a caller on hold that I forgot about. Is there a caller here that I need to apologize to? Hello? Hello? I guess I forgot to hang up. So there is no caller on hold, but a listener asked me if I had a caller on hold. The line's been busy, so I screwed that one up. Listeners, the line is clear. 1-866-687-7223. And if you were a caller on hold, waiting about as long as it's going to take us to get to Mars or someplace, please do call back. 1-866-687-7223. You know, your response to that question is not that different from what other people have said who have received that same question. You do have a caller now. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, please?
This is John in Atlanta.
Thank you for asking me if I had a caller on hold. I hope I didn't offend or lose someone. Go ahead for Eric, please.
Well, a lot of the issues, I guess you've touched on a few times, but that really kind of drives this whole issue. Of course, the medical issues are also becoming very serious, as well as I can see, is the propulsion aspects. And I'm wondering, we really seem to have a lot of things at conceptual level, maybe a laboratory level on propulsion, but we really need to have some major advance in propulsion to really even consider such missions as this. What's your thoughts on all this?
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of Franklin Candias because for the last, 30-odd years, he's been working on something called the Variable Specific Impulse Magnetoplasma Rocket, or the VASIMIR. And this is the most realistic propulsion system that we have right now in terms of its development that can actually get us to Mars quicker. When we're talking about 35 to 37 days to Mars using this propulsion system and 5 years return mission to the outer planets, which is Callisto. And it's moved to such a technology level now that they're going to be test flying this on the International Space Station in 2 to 3 years' time. So they're actually going to use a downgraded version of the interplanetary version to actually boost or help boost the International Space Station altitude. So this is going to be flown. I think it's a 200 kilowatt version on the International Space Station in 2014. And if that's successful and it's upgraded, then hopefully in 10 years or so we can actually get to Mars in 39 days. So this particular propulsion system is the most realistic in terms of getting us to where we want to go quicker.
Yeah, I tend to be a big advocate of that, but the thing we're also dealing with there is also developing a nuclear energy source sufficient to power a mission like that, and that's a whole separate animal we have to address.
It is. I mean, that's one of the criticisms of the system is that it isn't big enough right now, but the development, the timeline of their development since in the inception of this, way back in 1979, I think it was, when they came up with the idea. I mean, they've continuously made progress along the lines of increasing the output. So right now, I think it's around 200 kilowatts. I think it needs to be 200 megawatts before we actually get to a system that we can actually use to get to Mars quicker. But, I mean, they're making progress. And right now, there's nothing else that is on the table that is as far progressed as the Vazimir.
Yeah, well, I definitely agree with that. I've noticed that the versions have been discussed on the Vazimir website are using argon as the propellant. And I'm wondering, why the reason for using argon as opposed to a hydrogen? Do you know anything about that subject?
See, I think it's because of the exhaust velocity and the temperatures. I think argon, because it's inert, results in lower exhaust velocities. Sorry, results in lower exhaust temperatures. I'm not exactly sure of that, but I think that might be one of the reasons.
I see. Okay. Well, yeah, but that's... okay, well, I just thought I'd kind of address those issues, because that and the human factors are your two big problems, and that I certainly have been long advocating a lot more push on developing these technologies and making them flyable.
Actually, in response to your question, I think another reason they use argon is because it's cheaper. So they could use xenon, but that costs about $2,000 per kilogram, and the argon repellent only costs about $40 per kilogram. And also, the other gases that they considered using are actually results in corrosive plasma. So what you would have if you actually used other gases, you'd actually have a problem with the propulsion system itself, the exhaust nozzle. That would be corroded after time, whereas argon does not result in the corrosive plasma. So
that's
basically,
very inert, yeah.
Yeah, the decision to use argon is based on cost and the type of plasma that's emitted.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
Okay.
Thank you, John. Listeners, that freezed the line, and I have cleared it, so you will not get a busy signal unless another caller is on. 1-866-687-7223. Elizabeth is in Seattle and sent in an email and said, it seems to me that the technology and engineering issues that you're talking about, including the bio issues, are a little bit premature. If, as you said earlier in the discussion, that we are soft and that younger people don't even care about going to Mars, and there isn't going to be much of a consensus for this, I would think that the focus has to be more or less on the communication to get people to want to do such a mission, to do the training, to get into the mode of doing the right kind of education, etc. If we have an ambivalent society, or again, to use your word, soft society, and I'm not just referring to America, but across in other countries as well, there's never going to be any emphasis to do such a mission. The handful of space cadets that want to do it will never control the policy that is going to be made. It has to be a bigger consensus. So how do you communicate and tell the story to get the people interested, stay interested for the long duration, so that they can do the work to make such a mission fall into place?
Well, I think the promotion should come from the obvious people, and the obvious people are the astronauts. So, for example, different countries have different ways of communicating space to the public. You look at the European Space Agency countries, you look at the Canadian Space Agency, and you look at the NASA, how NASA does it. In Canada, for example, every astronaut who signs on for the Canadian Space Agency is contracted to do 2 blue suit days every single month, no matter where they are. So if you're down in, if you're down training in Johnson Space Center, you might have to get on a plane to go to Iqaluit up in the north. So it's you know, a 15-hour journey to go up to Iqaluit up in the north, near the North Pole, and give a presentation to school children there. Or you might have to go to Vancouver one weekend and do a blue suit day there. And because of that, the Canadian Space Agency has done a very, very good job in terms of public relations. The Canadian public generally are very aware of where their money goes in terms of the budget for the Canadian Space Agency. We don't have a big one. And a lot of that is due to these blue suit days that these astronauts go on. So I think that's one step that we can do. To give you an idea of how effective that is, we're a country of 30 million people. And the last astronaut selection that we had 5,335 people apply for 2 positions. NASA, by contrast, the United States has over 300 million for it. You're 10 times bigger than us. They had only 3,800 applications for 9 positions. That gives you an idea of just how much in the public perception space exploration is.
Not there,
so
is
I think it? That's one thing that can be done, is to get these astronauts out there when they're not training for missions and actually just talk to people.
Okay. You have a question from a fellow Canadian. This is Will in Waterloo, Ontario. Dr. Seathouse, what do you think the standard will be for commercial and government astronauts in maybe 10 years? Will commercial astronauts need PhD-level education, or do you see the barriers to becoming an astronaut being much lower than they are now in about a decade from now?
Yeah, I think they'll be lower. For suborbital and orbital will be a distinction, and for missions to the moon and beyond will be a distinction there. So there will be different levels of qualifications required. So, for example, astronauts for hire, that's what we do. We select flight members to go on suborbital flights. We do not require that they have a PhD. We require they have a master's degree and have a bunch of other things, such as survival training and emergency egress training and various other aspects related to astronaut training, but they're not required to do a PhD. As long as they have a master's degree and they have a science background and they can do the job of a payload specialist, then that's good enough for us. But in terms of 10 years down the road, then yes, that I think will be 3 tiers of qualifications. So those conducting suborbital operations will not need to be as qualified as those conducting orbital operations, and those conducting orbital operations will not need to be as qualified as those going off to the moon and Mars and beyond.
So beyond low Earth orbit will be the most, you'll need the most qualifications.
Yeah. And the selection process will be more rigorous as well, because of the reasons we talked about, such as the exposure to radiation. Obviously, in low Earth orbit, you're protected from radiation to a certain degree. Once you're out of the low Earth orbit, then you have a much more, you have a higher radiation bombardment.
We're coming up on the excuse me, on the end of the program. What have I not asked you that I should have asked for that you want to be sure to tell us, or that we have forgotten to discuss?
Well, I'd just like to reemphasize that people know that there are people out there like Mark Haldeman and the Advanced Concepts team at the European Space Agency that are doing research that sounds like science fiction, but they're actually doing this. This is actually happening. So people are actually doing research into human hibernation. People are actually designing spaceships, even though it's only on a computer, actually designing spaceships to go beyond Mars and to the outer planet. So this is actually happening, so don't give up.
And you have a couple more books in the works, right?
Yeah, so the next book is Astronauts for Hire. That comes out next month. And then Pulling G, which is about the human reactions to high and low gravity, that comes out in late summer this year. And then after that, hopefully writing a book about SpaceX.
Well, hopefully you'll give me a heads up and we'll do some more programming about your new books. How long does it take you to write one of these books? You've written, what, about 9 of them so far?
10 right now.
10.
Yeah.
How do you do it?
Well, first of all, usually subjects that are close to my heart, and so I don't have to do that much research to write them. So they're quite, they're not all easy to write. This is actually the toughest book to write of all the ones I've written. But generally, from actually getting the green light from the publisher to finishing it and sending it to the copy editor takes about 3 months, 3.5 months.
You're a very prolific author. And listeners, his other books, some of which we have talked about on the program before, Tourist in Space, A Practical Guide, Lunar Outpost, The Challenges of Establishing a Human Settlement on the Moon, Martian Outpost, The Challenge of Establishing a Human Settlement on Mars, The New Space Race, China versus the United States, Prepare for Launch, The Astronaut Training Process, Ocean Outpost, The Future of Humans Living Underwater. I don't think we did that, did we, Eric?
Well, no, we didn't, because it's not really space-related. But we can do that if you like.
No, I actually would like to do that. I'm really attracted to the water. Let's set up a time and talk about that. And then Trailblazing Medicine, we did that one, of course.
Yeah.
Sustaining Explorers During Interplanetary Missions. I would really urge all of you to get a hold of Eric's books. I can't say they're easy to read, but they're in a format that makes them really desirable to read. But they're chock full of real information that I think you will find very, very beneficial. And, until the next time when we do Oceans and some of your new books coming up, I'll look forward to talking to you again.
That sounds good, David.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. Listeners, that is it. We have a regular Monday program. Tuesday is Open Lines. We have a special AIAA policy of the U.S., is that the way to say it? Space policy, U.S. space policy program, Thursday morning. We have a regular Friday show and no program on Sunday. I'm doing another one of these What Should Our Space Policy Be Like panels. This is at the Tech Museum in San Jose, California. So no show on Sunday. Special thanks to Dr. Eric Seathouse. Again, we were talking today about Interplanetary Outpost. I'll put the links to the Amazon page for it in the archives, The Human and Technological Challenges of Exploring the Outer Planets. Thank you all for listening and participating. Goodbye from the Space Show.